Well, setting the record straight, Chuck Coughlin again, on breadboxmedia.com. This is part two of Mother of Our Laws, the Catholic Church. And in part one, I arrived at the point in history where there entered a man called Niccolò Machiavelli, who wrote a work called The Prince, in which he outlined certain principles that aren't the principles of the Catholic Church. Machiavelli lived from 1469 to 1527, and he was an Italian diplomat, politician, historian, philosopher. You could consider him a humanist, and he was a fine writer, had a great style in the Italian language, and he's usually considered the father of modern political science. Machiavellianism is a widely used negative term to characterize unscrupulous politicians of the sort Machiavelli described most famously in The Prince. He talked about immoral behavior, such as dishonesty and killing innocents, as being normal and effective in politics. He even seemed to endorse it in some situations. And he was the secretary to the second chancellor of the Republic of Florence, Fiorenzi. But that was when the Medici were out of power. His work, The Prince, came out in 1513. It was very influential. Machiavelli was just observing what went on around him. And what did go on around him? Well, what he observed, it wasn't necessarily that virtue triumphed over dishonor or truth over lies. To succeed in the world, sometimes one can follow a rather cold-hearted path and apparently succeed. And his work, The Prince, in promotion of secularism and amorality in political matters. This idea had immense influence and inspired the opposition among the 16th century Spanish scholastics of the Catholic Church, who further articulated refinements on the just war theory as a result. According to the Catholic Church, no one, not even the state, was exempt from the demands of morality. In subsequent centuries, just war theory has proven an indispensable tool for proper moral reflection. And philosophers working in this tradition in our own day have drawn from these traditional principles to meet the specific challenges of the 21st century. You remember I wanted to give you a modern Machiavellian example? Here it is. About 5 years ago, we were having a presidential election. Both candidates for Vice President of the United States came to a college close by where I live. It was to be a debate between two candidates for the Vice Presidency of the United States. Both of these men were Catholics, well-known Catholics. The subject of abortion was put to both of them. One stated that he was opposed to it. The other stated that he was just as good a Catholic as his opponent, and he was also opposed to abortion. However, as an elected office holder, he would not impose his own morality on someone else. At this, the entire student body of this supposedly enlightened institution rose and applauded. They cheered. This very modern gentleman had concisely stated the Machiavellian principle in politics. He was separating his morals from his business life, from his political life. His morals were for his personal time, but when he would step into the office, he would operate on the principles of what is convenient and what is efficient, and would wield political power in order to get rid of inconvenient people, inconvenient small people, small voiceless people. So these students leapt to their feet and cheered, applauding the modern version of The Prince. It was Niccolò Machiavelli's night. The vice presidential debate of the candidates that night on that campus of one of the most highly rated small universities in the United States was won not by Western Christendom, but by Niccolò Machiavelli. What an enormous influence Machiavelli has had. Apparently now we prefer leaders who leave their morality at the door when they go to the office. We're in the midst of a cultural war of two strains of thought, those of Christendom and those of Machiavelli. Perhaps we should talk about sexual morality. Ancient sources inform us that sexual morality had reached a particularly degraded point at the time of the appearance of the Catholic Church in history. A contemporary writer observed that widespread promiscuity had caused the Romans to lose the goddess chastity. Ovid observed that sexual practices in his day had grown especially perverse, even sadistic. Similar testimonies to the state of marital fidelity. Caesar Augustus attempted to curb this kind of immorality through the law. The law can rarely reform a people who have already succumbed to the allures of quick gratification. By the 2nd century, Tacitus contended that a chaste wife was a rare phenomenon. On the other side of the question, the Catholic Church was teaching that intimate relations were to be confined to husband and wife. Even the anti-Catholic Edward Gibbon, who blamed Catholicism for the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, was compelled to admit the dignity of marriage was restored by the Christians, by which he means Catholics. The 2nd century physician Galen, so struck by the rectitude of Catholic sexual behavior, described them as, quote, so far advanced in self-discipline and intense desire to attain moral excellence that they are in no way inferior to true philosophers. There was even a change in the definition of adultery. We were in the era in which the Catholic Church had an immense influence in raising the status of women. The Catholic Church has had more influence on raising the status of women than any other entity in history. I'm covering that issue in detail extensively in forthcoming podcasts. Perhaps this accounts in part for why women formed the majority of the Christian population of the early centuries of the Church, and the majority of the martyrs of the Colosseum, too. So numerous were female Catholics that the Romans used to dismiss Catholicism as a religion for women. Part of the attraction that faith held for women was that the Catholic Church sanctified marriage, elevating it to the level of a sacrament, and forbidding divorce, which really meant that men could not leave their wives with nothing to go marry another woman. Women attained substantially more autonomy thanks to Catholicism. They found protections in the teachings of the Church and were permitted to form communities of religious nuns who would be self-governing, something unheard of in any culture of the ancient world. Look at the catalog of saints filled up with women. Where else in the world, other than in Catholicism, were women able to run their own schools, convents, colleges, hospitals, orphanages outside of Catholicism? The Catholic Church is Christ's instrument that teaches that a life truly benefiting humanity requires the assistance of divine grace. Even pagan Romans perceive something of the degraded condition of man. I've talked about Seneca. He said, "What a contemptible thing is man, if he fail to rise above the human condition." Well, the grace of God could help him do so, and did. Here the Catholic Church has held out the examples of the saints, who demonstrate that lives of heroic virtue are possible when human beings let themselves decrease so that Christ may increase. The good life is not simply one in which our external actions are beyond reproach. Christ insists that it is not enough to merely refrain from murder or adultery. Not only must the body not yield to such crimes, but the soul must also keep from leaning toward them. We should not only not steal, we should not envy. And someone wishing to lead a good life should not want to make a fellow human being into an object or a thing. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates had famously said that knowledge was virtue, and that to know the good was to do the good. Aristotle and St. Paul knew better, for we can all recall moments in our lives at which we knew perfectly well what the good was, but did not do it. One must practice self-discipline. When you start dreaming of cupcakes, perhaps you ought to choose a carrot. It's not that the cupcake is going to do that much harm, but for the great good that self-denial does. It becomes habitual, in small things and then in greater things. As Aristotle observed, virtuous living becomes ever easier the more we engage in it, and the more it becomes a matter of habit. These are some of the distinctive ideas that the church has introduced into the world civilizations. Far too many of younger people have heard the church's teaching on human intimacy only in caricature, and given this culture within which they live, cannot begin to understand why the church proposes it. The Catholic Church holds out a moral alternative for young people. Immersed in a culture that relentlessly teaches them to pursue immediate gratification. The Catholic Church speaks to young people, telling them, you can aspire to be one of these saints, one of these builders of civilization, a great genius, a servant of God and humankind, or a heroic missionary. Or you can be a self-absorbed nobody fixated on gratifying your appetites. Our society does everything in its power to assure that you will end up on the latter path. I've been talking about morality, about Catholic morality, but what I'm leading up to is the morality is the foundation of law. All legislation is founded in morality, and it's morality that we must be discussing when we make the laws. We need to bring morality out into the open. What does your morality say to you? We need to ask our fellow citizens. We need to assume that they're going to operate on those principles that they hold if they intend for us to vote for them. Can you explain your morality? Or do you have an unconscious morality, an unacknowledged, inherited morality? Are you like one of those remote control cars that is steered by some distant intelligence of which you're unaware? But what I'm leading up to is a discussion of law. Law itself. So what does all this have to do with the Catholic Church being the foundation of our laws, the mother of our laws? There's an interesting story how the Catholic Church codified the first international law. By codified, I mean this is a written down, agreed upon set of laws. The Church invented the first international laws, the very idea and principle of international law. To say that the Catholic Church is the universal church, the Catholic Church, in other words, is also to mean that it is the global church. On a smaller scale, it being the universal church, it is also the global church. Governments are national governments. We do not have a global government. The Roman Catholic Church is the greatest international global networking institution. Networking is an interesting topic, which I will also cover in greater detail another time. But the point here is that the Catholic Church's canon law was a foundation for English common law, which is the foundation for the system of law that we in the United States operate under. And much of the world does the same. You may be familiar with the use of the word canon, C-A-N-O-N. A canon is a collection of organized statements, each one outlining a law. They're presented in a highly structured and organized style. Yes, the Catholic Church did provide the foundation for Western law, for the canons of Western law. But not just in a general way, but I'm going to show you in a very specific way the Catholic Church is the foundation of Western law. So we're discussing the process by which law developed. But the point here is that the Catholic Church's canon law was a foundation for English common law, which is the foundation for the system of law that we in the United States operate. So where are we? The laws of the Catholic Church were enumerated, and they were enumerated in a very organized way, interrelated way, because they were based upon the same foundational principles, Catholic principles. This was done by a man who was a genius. He was a monk and a scholar. His name was Gratian. We'll talk more about him. In the Catholic Church's law, it's canon law. The Western culture saw its first example of a modern legal system, of what would evolve into the modern legal system. In light of that model, modern legal traditions took shape, were born, and developed. The Western concept of criminal law was deeply influenced, not only by the canon law's legal principles, but actually by Catholic theology. Most particularly, the doctrine of atonement is developed by St. Anselm. For a long time, it was assumed by many scholars that the concept of natural rights rights that don't come from the government, but the rights of man, sort of evolved out of the liberal thinkers of the 17th to 18th century, sort of developed by natural evolution, fully formed. But that's not the case. In fact, this concept of natural legal rights, upon which our Constitution in the United States is based, derives from Catholic canonists, popes, philosophers, and scholars. The more scholars examine the traditions of Western law, the more clearly we see the imprint of Catholic theology and canon law upon our civilization. The architecture is the same. Legal scholar Harold Berman, a renowned Harvard professor, educated my brother. He said that the more we examine Western law, we see that it is a secular residue of religious attitudes and assumptions, which historically found expression first in the liturgy and rituals and doctrines of the Church. In context, he's referring to the Catholic Church, and thereafter in the institutions and values of the law. When these historical roots are ignored or not understood, many parts of the law seem to lack any underlying sense or validity. Professor Berman, in his magisterial work, entitled The Formation of the Western Legal Tradition, in this work he has documented the immense influence of the Catholic Church on the Western legal tradition. Western concepts of law are in their origin, and therefore in their very nature, intimately bound up with Western theological and liturgical concepts of atonement and the sacraments. Even the concept of separation of church and state was developed after Constantine's Edict of Milan, which extended toleration to Christianity, to Catholicism, in 313 AD, Anno Domini. The king was just another layman, a man-ordained figure who had no right to intervene in the affairs of the church. So the Gregorian Reform clarified the boundaries that must separate church and state if the church is to enjoy the liberty she needs. So shortly thereafter, legal codes were drawn up in both church and state, in which the powers and responsibilities of each were set down and made explicit. As the first systematic body of law in medieval Europe, canon law, that is, Catholic Church law, became the model for various legal systems that would now begin to emerge and are still emerging. Before this development of canon law in the 12th and 13th century, nothing resembling a modern legal system existed anywhere in Western Europe. Law prior to this had been intimately bound up with custom and kinship, and was thought of as a distinct branch of learning and analysis, independent of these things. Canon law had never been systematically codified, and consisted instead of scattered remarks. Some were from ecumenical councils, some from penitentials, some from popes, some from individual bishops, some from the Bible, some from the church fathers, and so on and so on. Much of the church law was regional in nature. It was not consistent from country to country and area to area. It was not universally applicable throughout Christianity as a whole. The 12th century began to change all that. The key treatise of canon law was the work of the monk Gratian. He called it a concordance of discordant canons. In other words, the harmonization of laws that appear to be in conflict with one another. It was written around 1140 Anno Domini. The Concordance is an enormous work, both in size and scope. It also is a historic milestone. According to Professor Harold Berman, it was, quote, the first comprehensive and systematic legal treatise in the history of the West, and perhaps in the history of mankind, if by comprehensive is meant an attempt to embrace virtually the entire law of a given polity, and if by systematic is meant the express effort to present that law as a single body, in which all the parts are viewed as interacting to form a whole. In other words, making laws organic, a body of law, in which the hand is in cooperation and based on the same system as the foot. Gratian's concordance appeared in a world in which custom rather than statutory law ruled so much of the ecclesiastical and the secular domains. Gratian and the other men who worked on these canons develop criteria based on reason and conscience for determining the validity of given customs, and held up the idea of a pre-political natural law to which any legitimate custom had to conform. So these men showed the West how to take a patchwork of custom, statutory law, and countless other sources, and produce from them a coherent legal order whose structure was internally consistent, and in which previously existing contradictions were synthesized or otherwise resolved. This provided a model for the secular systems that were codified in the wake of the Concordance. The codifiers made use of the scholastic method and of a natural law theory, and they were able to create out of these various sources, as well as out of the existing customs of their contemporary ecclesiastical and secular society, a coherent and rational legal science. When we examine the rules by which canon law sought to determine the criminality of a particular act, we discover legal principles that have since become standard in all modern Western legal systems. Canon lawyers were concerned with the intent of an act, with various kinds of intent, and with the moral implications of various kinds of causal connections. The same canonist introduced the equally modern principle that extenuating factors could exempt someone from legal liability. Ancient Roman law had distinguished between deliberate and accidental actions. The canonists also drew upon the newly rediscovered law code that had been drawn up during the reign of the 6th century Emperor Justinian, Emperor of the Byzantine Empire, the Justinian Code. But they made important contributions and refinements of their own, and introduced them into European societies that had known nothing of these distinctions during the numerous centuries under the barbarian influence. Our secular legal systems bear the distinct imprint of Catholic theology. They include the process of atonement. This is based upon the penance given in the sacrament of reconciliation. This principle was explained in the work of St. Anselm of Canterbury just after the turn of the first millennium. Now, St. Anselm belongs to the early history of what we call Scholasticism. Scholasticism is an enormously significant and influential chapter of Western intellectual history. It reached its height in the work of St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. It persisted to the 16th and 17th century.
Oh, he was a saint, yes, but he was devoted to reason. St. Anselm was a man devoted to reason. And incredibly, he used his reason and a reasonable explanation to prove the existence of God. You try to challenge his logic, I dare you. If you are intrigued, don't just read Aquinas. Read St. Anselm, too. So we've seen in this program that Catholic morality, even Catholic liturgy, provided the basis for a coherent, integrated, international, global system of laws, enumerated laws, enumerated, organized. Gossian began it, but it continues in the continued articulation of international law, a law that rides above, indeed, soars above the law of individual nations, informing them, shaping them, through the agency often unacknowledged of Catholic morality, usually unacknowledged. The danger is that we let it slip away, thinking it is only an evolutionary product, and that we're involved in an endless improvement of mankind's reasoning and humanity, rather than resting upon an absolute and unchanging foundation of absolute laws, of God's laws, unchanging, the Word of God, transmitted through this vehicle, the Catholic Church. I hope I've helped to set the record straight. The Catholic morality, Catholic theology indeed, the nearest thing we have to relate to that today is international law and the UN, although that's a paltry thing compared to the influence of the Catholic Church for 2,000 years, which is the vehicle for the Word of God. The unchanging, the absolute. Well, that's it. Here on breadboxmedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coffin, doing my small part to myth bust, to set the record straight about the glorious history of our beloved Catholic Church. Join me again.